Hi, how you doing? My name is Harry Brown. I'm a lecturer in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology, who, along with AFRI and the Irish School of Ecumenics, have brought Alexander Coburn here to Dublin this week. We have the unusual circumstance of having a warm-up act for Alexander tonight, and it's in the form of a song from John Francis. Is John here? Come on.
This is an anti-war song, fresh from the States. Disappearing those Shenandoah pines. John Brown, you are alive and well. John Brown, you are alive and well. Some will call you hero, others call you fool, but your firehouse still blazing in the hills. Wear it like a banner. Such indifference in the lap of luxury. There are those among us who still believe. Oh, say, can you see things are not as they seem? From sea to shining sea. Dr. King, Dr. King, I know you're listening. They cannot kill dreaming. It was a great proud nation called the States. It was a great proud nation called the States. 100 years from now, they'll be thumbing through the page. The history books will tell of our mistakes. Watch the people bleed. Fell asleep and watched the people bleed. And on that day, her headstone, the epitaph will read, she died of lust and greed. Oh, say, can you see things are not as they seem? From sea to shine. Dr. King, Dr. King, I know you're listening. They can kill the dreamer, but they cannot kill the dream. It's Montgomery and Wounded Knee. Montgomery and Wounded Knee. It's Baghdad and D.C., Jerusalem, Tel Aviv. And the first thing I did right was the day I started this fight. Raise your fist, resist, and then be free.
A piece of music so steeped in American history and in American landscape and in American music in a way that Alexander Coburn, though he grew up here in Ireland, I think would completely empathize with.
Yeah.
There's little need for me to introduce Alexander Coburn. I presume if you're here, you probably know something about him. He's given us, many of us, a great deal of pleasure over the years. He is one of the most ruthless and scathing critics of his and indeed our opponents, and I think we all enjoy him for that. But we also enjoy his enjoyment of it. We enjoy the pleasure that he takes in the English language. We enjoy the pleasure that he takes in the good things of life. He will turn from writing about politics to writing about food to writing about music. And he's a man of genuine culture and someone who brings real joy into his work. Just on the way down here tonight, he was reminiscing about dancing with Miss Ireland in a nightclub in Nassau Street in 1957. And earlier, he was talking about writing leaders from the Irish Times when he was still a teenager, writing leading articles for the Irish Times and the terrible deadening effect it had on his prose for many decades to come. So, with no further ado, because he's who you're here to hear, and I give you Alexander Coburn.
Thank you, Harry, for those excessively generous words. Well, I guess it's Bush. Did he land? Yeah, is he making light conversation to the Queen? In the first state visit of American president since Woodrow Wilson, 1918, shows the decline in American civilization from Wilson to Bush. And Wilson wasn't so great, but Bush, my God. I'm going to do some UN bashing. But I thought, since I'm from the States, that maybe I'd preface it with a little tidings from the other side of the Atlantic. Like many left formations around the world, the American left is prone to pessimism. I mean, there's a lot to be pessimistic about, usually, but it's always rather slow to see the good news, because it's congenitally always telling people the bad news. And I've always been of the belief, as a journalist, that people like a little up. And it's not, you can't just... My father remembers when he was in New York, in Union Square one time, and he could hear a communist organizer trying to rally people to the communist standard. This is in the 30s. And the communist organizer said, "Brothers and sisters around the world, millions of communists are writhing in the dungeons of the oppressor. Millions more are suffering the vilest tortures for their beliefs. Join the Communist Party." And it seemed to lack appeal, you know. And in a way, now the news is pretty good. I mean, we saw the anti-war movement build up to one of the largest collective manifestations of solidarity against war in the history of the planet. I think it was the largest. And pretty much everything that the anti-war movement said turned out to be true. Uncannily accurate predictions. As opposed to the right wing, the neoconservatives around Bush, many of whom were liberals under Kennedy, who depicted an easy walk into Iraq, a quick settlement, the musical chairs in the Middle East rearranged, to the satisfaction of the United States, maybe of Israel, trouble-free, a vastly increased U.S. presence in Central Asia, and the whole thing seemed a dream scenario. And now what do we have? We have what's going on. It's a staggering humiliation for U.S. imperial power of a major sort. You've got the whiff of panic in the air. You've got Bush's ratings down at 51. 49, and you've got emboldened resistance in the States. So that news is pretty good. But what is coming against the Bush, the politics of Bush? And this begins us to get into the theme about the UN, because currently the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination in the United States is Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont. Now, Dean is commonly called anti-war. And if you want to get a sense of the depth of his commitment to peace, you really should go back and look at what Dean was saying in the spring, right about the time that the hot war began, the actual invasion of Iraq. And Dean was indeed saying, this should be done under the auspices of the UN. He didn't always say that. Sometimes he'd said if the UN didn't agree, then the US should go in anyway. He could turn on a dime one day to the next and say the one or the other. So you can say two things. You can say, well, Dean is a hypocrite. He's calling for the UN. Or then he's calling if the UN doesn't click its heels and say, go for it. He's going to say, the US should just go in with the UK and the coalition of the willing. Pretty scanty coalition it is. Or you can say that's a very accurate resume of what the function of the UN actually is. That it's nothing much more than an after-sales service provider for the US. Now, historically, the left has always tended to click its heels when the word UN is mentioned. It's always counterposed to the arrogance of imperial power. You have the image of the UN as a body deliberating, voting, maybe offering a more pacific version and so forth. And that's deeply ingrained in liberals and leftists and people of progressive beliefs. In America, you can go from city to city and you'll have federal societies and these people, and they really are devoted, very devoted to the idea of the UN as a real alternative to US imperial power. But it is a rather unhistorical vision, and I think one that leads us very much astray if you don't really see what the actual history of the UN has been. And I speak as someone who, I went to Oxford in 1961, and the first speech I ever gave was attacking the UN for its role in subverting Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. And the most violent demonstration I think I ever went on was outside the Belgian embassy the night that the news came that Lumumba had been murdered, basically by the connivance of the Belgians and the US. And the UN had been very instrumental in that, in the downfall of Lumumba. So I myself instinctively rather don't see the UN in quite the benign terms that many do. But after all, when you look at what the circumstances of the founding of the UN were, they were not founded by, you know, benign federalists. The UN was coaxed and basically brokered into being by a triumphant United States that was seeing itself as inheriting the mantle of world power after World War II. First under Roosevelt and then under Truman. And you can read the discussions and you can see on the one hand that it was a very nice rhetorical setup that they said here is a body that's going to contain all the countries of the world. Wonderful. At last, a global body. And it is going to be devoted to the cause of peace. And it's hard, you know, you can't go around denouncing peace. So you've got now worldwide and peace. So you've got two huge assets for the UN. But simultaneously, you've got correspondence with Roosevelt when he said the whole thing was going to be run by the US through the Security Council. And he said, and the people who, two powers objected, one was the Soviet Union under Stalin, the other was the UK under Churchill. And Roosevelt said, you know, we will have absolute control through the Security Council. And so it came to pass. So with the founding of the UN in 1945 in San Francisco, you had on the one level the hopes of the world, very genuine hopes. My father covered it for the Daily Worker, actually, and can remember going across the states, and they ran special trains across the states, and people would walk up to the train, came out of the prairies, out of the plain states, and all the states across. People had fought, you know, knew that their husbands and sons had fought, and they'd go and touch the train. Now, there was real belief, just as there is still belief as to what the UN can do and what the UN could be. And then the trains, you know, their trains arrived in San Francisco, where the U.S. Secretary of State, the former head of U.S. Steel, Stettinius, was sitting in the Fairmont Hotel with the all the delegates from all of the countries that around them being bugged by the U.S. military regularly. All the transcripts of what they were saying was provided to Stettinius the following morning. And the whole thing was jimmied into what in reality was a totally U.S.-dominated institution. And simultaneously to that, what you had going on was the other U.S. security network to ensure its increasing global domination, which was the system of regional alliances. And the person who was very powerful at that UN founding convention was Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller had come straight from Mexico, where he'd brokered the Treaty of Chapultepec, which was billed as the US and Latin American nations protecting each other, but was in fact, like all these things always are, basically a security arrangement whereby the US would continue to prop up brutal elites throughout the Americas. Nothing new. But that went on simultaneously to the founding of the UN. So you can see which way the wind was blowing. And then after Roosevelt had died, Truman, who took over, and Dean Acheson, his Secretary of State, thought that the UN really was a bit chancy, even though they had absolute control through the Security Council, and they began to build up this alternative system of security alliances, CETO, CENTO, NATO, and so forth. And that was the conditions under which the UN came into being. Now, all through the decades that followed, there was always the hope, you know, that the UN would act as a countervailing balance to ever-increasing U.S. power. And for a time, it did seem to be happening. And there were people here, I'm sure, can remember, you know, hopeful things. Some of them, actually, boosted by the foreign minister of Ireland at the time, Aiken. The phrases like positive neutralism, the non-aligned groups. And that sense that the UN was producing an alternative global political culture, I think really climaxed probably in the 70s with the idea of the New World Economic Order, whereby third world countries would have new arrangements where they wouldn't be looted of their basic commodities, where they get a decent price for their commodities, whether it was bauxite from Jamaica or whether it was timber or whether it was oil. And you would have a new world information order, whereby the dominance of the imperial powers in terms of information would be challenged. You would have various international treaties which would restore the balance between rich and poor, such as the law of the sea. And these were all ardently sought after, ardently debated, particularly in the UNCTAD, which is the Trade and Development Agency of the UN. And within a few years, it was all gone. Why was it all gone? Because that whole, those decades of a different idea of development of third world countries, where you, before neoliberalism arrived, where you would actually have some measure of state control, you would have third world countries with some measure of protection of their public assets. By the mid-70s and the early 80s, that was all swept away. And you had what we now call the beginning of the neoliberal era, where you talk about the triumph of the free markets. What is the triumph of the free market? Of course, it's surprising open a poor country, you know, looting its public assets. Let's say you take a Latin American country, you get all its hospitals, its telephone system, you name it, everything, and sell it off, usually to first world people who will, again, strip it of its assets, make a few bucks, and then move on. The classic example is Argentina, where Argentina did absolutely everything it was told to do. It hooked its currency to the dollar. It, you know, stripped everything out of the place. The place was bare. And it collapsed. The economics minister fled the country with the president. Newspapers in the United States, which had praised it, Argentina as the paradigm experiment in neoliberal discipline, all suddenly fell silent and began to look the other way. You know, huge food riots in Argentina. And that was it. And that was really the paradigm model of what neoliberal economics can do. And after all, what are the presiding institutions of that, which are institutions that are tied into the UN system, which, of course, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And when you look back at it, the US, the people who contrived that system of global domination were not stupid people. I think the people now running US foreign policy are stupid people. It's impossible to look at them and not come to that conclusion. I mean, you cannot look at someone like Rumsfeld and think this man is really a very, very stupid human being. And I think he's now daily appearing more and more so, and we won't even go on about the mental capacity.